This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Joyce Goh and Tan Chung Han. And the morning run begins. It is the 7th of August. We're taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock in the morning with a range of interviews, news and analysis. Welcome.
Good morning.
Yeah, absolutely. A good morning. Except in some parts of the world, Lombok suffered another earthquake, and I believe some of the papers this morning reflect the devastation there. Almost 100 people killed, I believe, and because thousands evacuated following those, I think, very high level, very strong quakes, right? About 7 on the Richter scale.
Yeah, and about 20,000 people have lost their homes, and they've also started evacuating about 2,000 tourists from nearby Gili Islands. So yeah, it's quite devastating.
Yeah, look, the Gili Islands, and I've said this several times before, you know, it's a popular vacation spot for myself and my friends, this is a reminder, a very solid reminder about, you know, the risks that you take when you go to that part of the world, because it's so beautiful, it's so serene. I go there often without thinking about it, you know, and then you've got this happening here. I mean, I saw this picture on the BBC.com. You've got thousands trying to leave the Gili Trawangan Island, and, you know, it just, you know, makes me think, you know, what if I had been there? Because I had actually been thinking about going to making another trip later this month.
Mm. Yeah, you know, of course we all take risks. I mean, even our own lives in our own neighborhoods. I mean, Klang, that's pretty risky.
Well, not the extent of a 6.9 earthquake.
We don't have earthquakes. Yeah, locally, I believe that's true. Now, you know, also in the news, very interesting developments in Bangladesh. What started out as youth protests in aid of road safety has turned into a major crackdown in Bangladesh. The use of thugs by the government, they fired rubber bullets at students. It's become quite a messy affair out there in Dhaka. Along with the many injured by authorities shooting at them, is the arrest of an award-winning Bangladeshi photographer. I put this in because I actually met him, interviewed the man. He's written a book about Malaysia and Bangladeshi workers in Malaysia, called Best Years of Our Lives. A very, very interesting man who runs an award-winning school of photography. And he's one of the arrested.
This is Shahidul Alam?
Shahidul Alam.
And does he come across as a provocative man, or, you know, is he that's...
Yeah, so one of the things that led to his arrest was an interview he gave with Al Jazeera.
Right.
Well, I can't tell. I mean, he's kind of part of that very cosmopolitan Bangladeshi segment of society, right? So speaks with a very clipped accent, very, very English sounding. He's an older gentleman in his 60s and has such a reputation internationally. I've actually been to an international photography festival where many of the entrants were actually his students, because I messaged him, because 3 out of the 17 in this international festival who were chosen were actually from Bangladesh. And then when I messaged him, he said, yeah, 2 of them are my students.
Mm. So it looks like Shahidul, again, 63-year-old Shahidul Alam, is just the latest in what has been a series of arrests of journalists and citizens over there in Bangladesh, all of whom have apparently been arrested without warrant. This is according to TheGuardian.com. They were also apparently prosecuted and jailed under the law. And, you know, human rights groups have criticized this as draconian. And even the Bangladeshi government apparently has admit that such laws had been misused.
Well, it all started because of a speeding bus. It killed 2 teenagers on July 29th, and this has gone out. And then they demonstrated, and look at where they are right now.
Yeah, in fact, Shahidul was brought to the police station. He could hardly walk because he'd been beaten up by thugs of the government or police officers. At this point in time, it's very unclear who's responsible for beating him up. At any rate, that's the news of the world. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Tommy James and the Shondells with Crimson and Clover. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Joyce Goh and Tan Chung Han. And it is the 7th of August. Remember, we're taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock in the morning with a range of interviews, news and analysis, all of which you can participate in by tweeting us at BFM Radio, WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899. Now, time to talk about something that perhaps we all have a part in, that is a screen addiction. Yes, many of us are not just addicted to the screen, we're addicted to flipping through things in this endless stream. Have you ever found yourself saying to yourself, okay, I'm going to stop doing this now, and then 10 minutes later, you're still flipping through your phone. Now, a school in Hong Kong is trying to solve the problem at an early age, and that's by banning mobile phones. And do you think that's a good idea?
Yeah, well, I mean, I recognize the intent that this school is trying to display, right, with this move to ban screens from its schools. But I would like to take another approach, and actually I have taken another approach whereby, you know, with the students that I work with, I try to instill a sense of discipline. So we actually incorporate digital devices into our classroom. So I'll send them reminders about homework via WhatsApp or even extra reading. I'll just send them the link via WhatsApp, or even during class, I'll be like, okay, let's Google search this particular topic that we're talking about, be it for business studies or econs, right? So the idea is to develop, you know, proper habits, if I can use the term there, whatever proper means, you know, or at least use it in the affirmative sense, as opposed to just saying, well, screens are just bad and we are going to ban them.
Well, I understand that going into the whole digital space is important given, you know, where we are today and technology is really big right now. But I don't get the whole smartphone thing. I get the whole laptop. If you need a computer at school, or you bring a laptop or something and like work on a computer and learn, I don't know, coding, or you know how to Google stuff and things like that. But to bring a smartphone to school, I don't know. Maybe because my kids are still young, I cannot. For me, they don't have a phone. I don't have any plans of getting them a phone anytime soon. I mean, how old do you think, you know, is the right age for them? Because in this article, it says that, you know, they can be really young. And a study conducted by scientists from Korea University says that brains of young people who use smartphones or internet access too much, it undergoes chemical changes, and you know it can cause them to get addicted to things.
Yeah, in fact, you know, I think the expression has been used to describe some of these strategies that designers have put into these interfaces, which is like cocaine on the brain. Mm. Basically, it's highly addictive, and you know they knew about it. So you know, though developers knew that what they were creating was highly addictive. Interfaces that would lead the person who's using it to just stay on that page, stay on with the website and continue to use it. Because after all, that is the source of their money, right? So these often advertising platforms like Facebook and such, and they need you to stay on there in order to reap profits.
Yeah, and in France, they've come up with this ruling where for school next year in September, there's a new law that prohibits students aged 3 to 15 from using mobile phones in school. Oh. From 3 years old, can you imagine?
Yeah, so
a toddler, a smartphone, I'm not sure. Maybe the toy, yeah. But
So the caveat here will be, you know, I guess whatever is age appropriate. Mm. Yeah, you know, for 3-year-olds, you know, I think you got to use a different set of rules versus a 15-year-old. Well, you know, then again, you can then ask, you know, how old is 15 really? You know, there are 12-year-olds who are perhaps more mature than some 15, 16-year-olds as well. But the idea, I mean, overall, we're talking about the principles here, right? If you are talking about, say, the addictive nature of some of these apps, then, you know, obviously the internet promises so much more beyond those apps, right? So I think it still can be used holistically and positively in an education setting. Obviously, the teacher or the role model in a class will then have to model that kind of behavior and show these students, well, hey, we can be constructive with our use of these screens. It doesn't have to be all about Snapchat. I mean, whether you like it or not, the kids are going to gravitate towards Snapchat and the like.
like?
You know, when I was teaching years ago at a local university, I found that the kids had their laptops open while I was giving the lecture. And because it was such a large class that, you know, sometimes the kids drifted off. And when I walked down the aisle, they didn't, you know, do what was necessary, which is to switch off that Korean drama they were watching and, you know, and pretend they were at least, you know, paying attention or had something related to the topic we were studying. So I think, in fact, it's a major distraction. Mm. I my personal view is, and I see where you're coming from, Han, you're trying to find a positive spin on what is inevitable or the inexorable addiction that will you know, grip these kids. But I think there's something to be said about total bans on things like that, because to survive without your phone in itself is a huge lesson in discipline. And I think that would be tremendous for young people.
Well, maybe you should have just made our lectures more exciting. How about that?
Ooh.
That is also one book. I concede. You know, sometimes, you know, demanding intellectual focus and, you know, is too much. Just too much to demand, you know. Not everything can be, you know, entertaining, as they say. Tell us what you think. You can always tweet us at BFM Radio. WhatsApp us is 018-789-8899. We'll be back. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That was Fat Boy Slim with Praise You. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Joyce Goh and Tan Chung Han. And it is the 7th of August and just 21 minutes past 6 in the morning. In Malaysia Baru, there are sort of new practices evolving. And in the state of Malacca, the government there is planning to open its doors to the public to become observers at the main meeting of the local government authority so that they can take a closer look at the policy-making process. You know, this is, of course, a part of the manifesto of the Pakatan Harapan government for more sustainable and transparent administration and management.
Right. And so when you look at these grassroots level meetings and all that, I guess can be quite dry. So I guess the question here is really, even with the doors flung wide open, how many of you would actually willingly step through those doors as well? I mean, because, for example, myself, right, I've attended some of my apartment complex meetings, or like those management meetings, and it can get quite mundane, or otherwise some residents will go off on their soapboxes, and, you know, I wonder how productive or how efficient those meetings really are. But for the record, I do agree with the principle, the intent there of, you know, opening those doors for more participation. Yeah,
I agree, Han, though. How many of us actually will go if they do open the doors? How many? I mean, in this case as well, they're saying that they're going to, in Malacca, right, they're going to open the doors so that people can have a closer look to the whole policy-making process of the local government authorities, right? How many people actually showed up for that?
Well, so can you imagine if everybody who was affected, everybody who's involved, which is essentially everybody, actually turned up? They probably wouldn't have space, right? They'd have to hire a stadium. So chances are that's not what they're anticipating. They're probably anticipating that it's people with specific problems or concerns that will turn up. It will be your local activists, whether on the environment or urban conservation, or somebody who's got some matter with the government, who would like to participate, who has something to say, who will be auditing these meetings. So I don't expect that there will be a rush, and you don't have to have that. Democracies don't work where with everybody 100% participation at all times. I mean, that's not the point. The point is access is given so that when you need to, you can. You can do it.
I guess that face-to-face interaction with these grassroots leaders are still imperative, you know, because you can still make those grouses known. You can still make those concerns known beyond the confines of that meeting, right? You know, now you can just send an email or tag somebody on Twitter. You've got the communications minister, for example, Gobind Singh, who's very active on Twitter, right? So it's perhaps no longer confined to just that 1-2 hour meeting. But I can understand the need for still that communal experience, and just being there and being able to see the non-verbal communication via being shown by those grassroots leaders as you you know, share your grouses.
I feel face-to-face meeting is still I think that's more effective. Maybe I'm old school. I don't know. Even when getting a story, I still need to go down to the ground, go meet my contact, you know, go have tetare and, you know, find out more whether or not that information's correct, you know, rather than to...
Just,
you know,
WhatsApp,
yeah,
really?
I mean, after forming a good relationship and you can trust the person, yeah, you know. But to tag someone on Twitter, someone that you don't randomly know, and it's very different from going down to the ground and seeing them. If you have matters to bring up. In this case, it's because if you have issues to bring up with your local council, right?
I mean, what if you could use the residence committee of, say, an apartment as something analogous, right? Because you do have management committees for buildings. And often, and I experienced this in the last couple of years, is that these meetings, and especially the annual general meetings and all that, open to all. In fact, they encourage all the owners. But participation rates are very low. And this is where people have a very direct interest. It's where they live. It is, you know, their direct environment. It is the value of their properties. All that, and yet participation rates are very low because the expectation is somebody else is going to look after the matter. I don't have to be invested because there'll be enough other people who are invested.
Okay, I mean, because with apartment complexes, I don't know about yours, Sharad, but for mine, there is a barrier to entry, though, whereby you got to make sure all of your bills are paid on time before they'll even let you into that meeting. So
That's good, no?
Yeah,
good.
I agree, right? Yeah. So because otherwise, you ain't got no say. If you're not paying your maintenance fees, you're not coming in, all right? So now, should that litmus test be then applied to these local council meetings as well? Unless if you pay,
your taxes
or whatever it is, or you've taken part in at least one gotong royong, okay, then you can come. Otherwise, nah.
Never mind about the gotong royong, but at least pay your taxes. I think surely that is the basis for participation. As they say, no taxes without representation. Representation. You want representation? You got to pay your taxes too. Okay. Taking us to the first bulletin of the morning, Beck with Black Tambourine. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That was George Harrison and Give Me Love. George Harrison, of course, fame from the famed Beatles. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Joyce Goh and Tan Chung Han. And it's just 40 minutes after 6 in the morning. It's the 7th of August. And remember, you can always be part of this conversation. Now, when you think of pom-pom girls and pop music and around an arena and something called a kiss cam, training its sights on unsuspecting couples, you might be thinking of American football or basketball, something, a game of that sort. But apparently, badminton has now adopted these practices. And the Secretary General of the Badminton World Federation, or BWF, says, and I'm going to quote him, says, "We see ourselves as part of the entertainment business, not only the sports entertainment business."
Well, have you never seen what the Kiss Cam does or how it works, Shrekton?
I've seen it in a movie.
Or on TV, something like, yeah. But I don't know, do you think this... I mean, I watch badminton because I like the sport. I don't need all these other, I don't know...
Distractions. You don't want to be caught with your husband at a stadium and then... you're forced to kiss that person, is it?
PDA.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so this has actually happened in Malaysia. Do we have kiss cams in Malaysia? We go to the Harimau Malaya games?
No.
Do you see many couples at football games in Malaysia?
Well, yeah, I do see couples. You'll see whole families come out, and some of them even have like a picnic at the stadium. You know, they've got a whole basket full of snacks and whatnot. Yeah,
that's very nice, actually. Yeah. In many parts of the world, I think of when my brother lived in Australia for a short while. You know, he was very into Australian football or footy, as they call it, right? And it's very family orientated. You know, yes, adult men are gouging each other's eyes out on the pitch, but it's in the stands, it's very civil.
Right. So this is an eternal debate between the sports purists versus the, those who are just there for the atmosphere. For example, I had to endure, keyword there being endure, some baseball games when I was in the States. It is a tremendously boring sport. Sorry, no offense there. It was so boring, whereby in between all these innings, I think like 7 or 9 innings, I can't even remember now, they would have some form of entertainment. There'll be chants, there'll be games going on for kids, you know, and whatnot. So you almost need all these distractions just to fill up the seats so that people actually pay and keep your sport or this stadium going or this particular team going, right? So it's going to be a struggle. On one hand, you've got those core supporters who love the sport and just enjoy it for what it is. And there's probably a sizable part of the local population who needs all this stuff to even walk through those turnstiles.
So, Han, you went to watch the baseball game because of the entertainment?
I went there because I was a girl.
Okay. Yeah. Ah, so this is where the kiss cam comes in.
It does seem really odd because, you might not like this sport or that sort. It doesn't really matter. But if you're really into a sport, what more than the sport itself do you need? Because in the downtime, you can talk about the strategies that were taken up by the individual players or the team strategy or the performance of somebody or the highlight of a moment that happened. I mean, there's so many things to be engaged with intellectually and emotionally. You know, you don't need... apparently, I would think, you know, anything in addition to it. You might think baseball is boring. What about cricket? Do you think cricket is boring?
Yes.
Okay, so there you are. You know, but, you know, a billion people in South Asia, people in, you know, the Caribbean and in many other parts of the world think it's an extraordinarily wonderful game.
Right.
And are obsessive about
it. Yeah, actually, of course.
They don't need kiss cam.
In the recent Wimbledon semifinal, Nadal versus Djokovic, that was epic. I mean, it was really long. I think it was quite a record that how long that whole game lasted. I forgot how long, but it was really long. And people just watched it because it's just
riveting,
so intense.
Wasn't it?
Yeah. And it was like everyone's saying this is actually the finals, which is true.
Okay, wait, hold on, Han. Do you think tennis is boring?
No, okay. I love tennis, right?
So obviously, tennis is awesome.
I love tennis. I love football. You know, heck, I'll even watch F1 while more so on the TV than actually in the stands because it's not as fun, you know, out there in real life. At least. In my
opinion. If you have a mobile phone, you can do both. You can be in the stands and you can also watch it on TV.
So that's exactly what happened when I went to F1, right? We were seated in front of this big screen and like you see the cars whiz by in like a split second and then the rest of the time you're just watching the race on the screen. So I'm like, why can't I do this at home? Now, unfortunately, I watched the race when they downgraded to the quieter engine, so the high wasn't as intense that year.
Actually, speaking about F1, I know a lot of people who like to go to the one in Singapore and just go network because it's known for their parties and the corporate boxes where you go and you see who's who and you get to rub shoulders with the corporate top dogs and you know so they go there more for that. I'm not so sure if they're going there to watch the sport. I'm not sure about that.
There we go. But, so isn't that a distraction as well?
That's for F1. I don't know. But for tennis, coming back to the Wimbledon semifinal, that was about 5 hours, 15 minutes, second longest semifinals in Wimbledon's history.
Yeah, look, so again, are all these other periphery events are distractions as well, be it the F1 or even in football, you've got these corporate boxes where people go there and have a nice meal and spend the whole afternoon. But really, it almost seems like the game is secondary because you're not really out there in the stands with the real fans, right? So this is a debate that will go on and on and on. I think, you know, in terms of the commercial viability of these sports, you almost need these kind of, for lack of better terms, gimmicks in order to make sure that people still come there. I mean, go to your stadium and spend money and keep your team alive.
Well, I think too many gimmicks in our lives at this point in time. Tell us what you think. You're going to tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp us 018-789-8899. Thank you very much to Ravi Kumar. He says, baseball, in my experience, is 3 hours of boredom and 15 minutes of excitement at the end.
Totally agree with you, Ravi. Also boring. Oh my gosh.
Of people think differently, but okay, that's your experience of. Also, Intan Sabrina has said that I'm not a sports fan, so to me, all sports are boring, especially Boxing Day Test cricket series. So, boxing and day test cricket. Okay. Yeah. There you have it. Okay, some people just not into it. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, The Hollies with Just One Look. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Joyce Goh and Tan Chung Han. It's 51 minutes past 6 in the morning, it's the 7th of August. And remember, we're taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock in the morning with a range of interviews, news and analysis. Now, something that, of course, has been occupying our discussions about politics in Malaysia over the last decade or so, the issue of hopping. So when somebody's elected, they decide they're going to change parties or change allegiances in the assembly. Question is, should it be penalised?
Yes, so now what you're saying is that there should be a law on for party defections and, you know, just to manage that. But again, do you need a law? You know, it's just the whole perception. If the person jumps ship and all that, you know, do you trust the person, and whether or not as a party, do you take on party defections?
Right. I guess given the realities, the political realities for Malaysia, you kind of need, especially for parties like Bersatu, who has arguably, I think they are the newest kid on the block, right, so to speak. And, you know, they need to gain mass in order to, you know, get the kind of political weight that they can throw around. So you almost don't want to forbid party hopping, because if that's the case, then that will rule out our current prime minister, right? So it's a bit of a high balance. But in terms of principles,
he didn't hop parties.
I mean, why is he fighting?
Well, because he wasn't elected as an UMNO member and then switched allegiances.
Yeah.
So I mean, so technically, so that's not an example of it.
It's not party hopping, but there is a switching of allegiances, right? So, you know, again, there is
which is different because because the issue really is when voters vote you in, they
because
vote you
of,
both
yeah.
of your. They're supposed to be voting
you
on who
and,
you are,
and maybe because of
the
your party,
party
yeah.
right? And
yeah.
so when you hop or switch allegiances, mm-hmm. then it's a betrayal of the voters. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the argument, at least. And that's something that the law, as proposed, or debated, is what is at stake. So it's not about people changing allegiances over time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I agree, Usha. And also, maybe in this case, if you are with a particular party, you've been voted in, and let's say you're with the losing team, and then you go, oh, I want to go join the winning team, but you're already with the losing team at the time, and you switch sides because of that. I don't know. How sincere is that?
Yeah. The question is, okay, so it's a question, you might be accused of being insincere or duplicitous or treacherous or whatever it is. The question is, who should punish you? Should it be the voter at the next election, the next round, or should it be the law? In this case, you know, a law that, say, prevents you from hopping parties or demands that you relinquish your seat and get, if you want that seat again, you have to go back to the voter and get, a mandate.
Yeah, look, whether or not that call has to be made, via the courts, you know, as in the law, or that decision should be made at the party level, whatever it is, I think that bar should be set higher as well, you know, because for far too long, you've got individuals and entire groups of people switching allegiances as if, you know, it's like a fad of sorts. I mean, for example, you got the GPS in Sarawak, you know, just because Barisan Nasional lost, then very conveniently, they are dropping their ties with BN and forming their own coalition. I can't remember what GPS stands.
Gabungan Parti Sarawak.
Yeah, there
but you
go.
See, but right. that's so, very different again, because here it is an alliance of a coalition of
sure.
parties, right?
Mm.
So unless you're saying that I voted for, say PBDS or SUPP only because it's part of Barisan Nasional. So and if that's the case, yes, then your voter can accuse you of betraying them because you've now taken your party out of that coalition. But it's yet another remove, right?
Remember what happened in G13? There was this thing, this case in Perak where this lady was with the opposition and they needed more numbers. I think BN needed more numbers to form.
Yeah.
And she switched. I think a lot of local people in Ipoh or was it Ipoh, wherever she was from, they were really upset.
Right.
And yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Look, at the heart of it all, it's what we're talking about, at least, you know, from what I'm seeing, is the switching of these political allegiances, right? Now, how it manifests itself, be it an individual switching parties or contesting under another flag, or parties also uprooting themselves and perhaps either forming or joining another coalition. I mean, is that not the heart of the matter, the switching of allegiances?
Well, the switching itself is not necessarily a bad thing. Say, for instance, if the leadership has proven itself to be, you know, egregious in, you know, in terms of or having committed egregious sins against the people, whatever it is, you know, being corrupt and lost their legitimacy, why should you, as a member of parliament or a state assemblyman, remain with that party, okay, right? So the three members of UMNO that have since left say they have lost confidence in the leadership of the party. So they have declared themselves independent.
Sure.
So is that a betrayal?
Now, that's on the push side, right? But what about on the pull side, whereby if you are in power right now, so if, let's say, you're somebody in Pakatan Harapan right now, and you see all these people, you know, oh, convenient timing, after G14, then switching allegiances. Can you trust these individuals? Can you trust these parties to stay with you for the long haul? Make sure that their adherence to your principles, your ideals are as intact versus the say, the Lim Kit Siangs and the Gobin Singhs and the, you know, the Azmin, well, maybe not Azmin Ali, but the Anwar Ibrahims, you know, etc., right? Because there's bound to be this disconnect. It's one thing to be able to trust people who have been with you from the beginning and saw the party and, by extension, the coalition rise up together versus somebody who just comes over, you know, after May 9th. Why? Because we are in power now.
Well, I think this law is actually directed at the voter, betrayal of voters rather than political parties. But this is a conversation that you can participate in. Remember, tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. We're coming up to the top of the hour. We'll have the next bulletin. Taking us there is Devendra Barnhart with Can't Help But Smiling. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.